Hello, you're with Australia Talks here on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn. I'm Paul Barclay. Have you heard the expression, cycling is the new golf? It seems everyone's putting on the lycra and riding their bikes, while at the same time, golf clubs are losing members, put off by expensive annual membership fees. And because we're so busy, we can't spare the 4 or 5 hours it takes for a round of golf. Yet Australia is about to host its biggest ever summer of golf. Tiger Woods is here. The Australian Open tees off in Sydney tomorrow. Then Melbourne will host the first President's Cup in Australia since 1998, followed by the PGA Championship at Coolum. Golf Australia is hoping this renewed focus on golf will revive interest in the game. It's a game I actually used to play, but no longer. What about you? Are you a fan? Do you like 9 or 18 holes of golf on the weekend? Or do you subscribe to the view, as expressed by Mark Twain, that golf is a good walk spoiled? I'd love to hear what you think. Call now on 1300 22 55 76 or post a comment on our website. Just search for ABC Australia Talks or tweet us at Australia Talks while you're playing a round of golf, perhaps. Or make sure that you use that hashtag AusTalks, A-U-S Talks. Love to hear from you whichever way you choose to contact us. But first of all, let me introduce you to tonight's golfing panel. Richard Fellner is the group editor of Inside Golf. Stephen Pitt is the CEO of Golf Australia. And Mike Clayton is a golf course architect and a former European Tour golf player. Richard, I'll come to you first of all. Welcome to Australia Talks.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why are so many golf clubs struggling at the moment? Am I right in saying that we are too busy these days, perhaps, to enjoy a sport that is rather time-consuming compared to other sports?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, clubs in general have been hurting a little bit as more and more people, go to other things, whether it's spending time with the family or, like you said, going to cycling or other activities. These days, a family unit has two people working. They have, the kids on the weekends, so there's not a lot of time like there used to be to spend. And you said 4 to 5 hours, but these days it's closer to 6 or more hours at the golf course.
Mm. Yes, and you feel rather guilty if you do say to your wife, who has to look after the kids on a Saturday or a Sunday, oh, I'm just going off to play a round of 18 holes with my mates and, of course, a few drinks at the 19th afterwards. Pretty much writes off a day, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. And, a lot of the guys trying to get that leave pass from the wife, there's so many stories of of guys, having to say what they have to say to get out and play golf. But you do feel guilty. You're done with your round. You have to have a couple of drinks. You chat at the 19th hole. And pretty soon your day is gone. And plus you have to travel back and forth between the course. So it's basically chewing up the entire day.
Yeah, that's true. And some golf courses are a fair way away from where you live as well. Okay, that's the issue of how long it takes to play a round of golf. What about the membership model? Does it also need to be overhauled? It can be quite expensive to join a golf club.
Absolutely. Well, a lot of golfers these days, and I don't have the exact number, but more and more golfers are abandoning private and club membership models, and they're going to, the public courses. So, the pay-for-play courses. It's a lot more affordable to the average household. You don't have the big commitment in terms of money and time. And there's so many great courses out here that it's harder for these private clubs to compete. Certainly, if you're a course like Royal Melbourne or Kingston Heath or some of those top-tier ones, you never really have to worry about memberships. But it's, the middle to lower-tier courses that are really starting to feel the pinch. And, when the average household, they have a fixed income, they can't really justify spending, $2,000 or $3,000 a year, whatever the number might be, on subscription fees plus a joining fee that can be, anywhere from $1,000 to whatever. This guy's the limit. Mm. It's a lot of money, especially when you consider you can play at a public course for, $50 and, there's no long-term commitment.
Yes. And Stephen Pitt from Golf Australia, some of those public courses are of quite a high standard, often comparable to the, say, middle-ranking membership courses. Do you think that old golf club membership model is broken?
I don't necessarily agree that it's broken. I think it's got some challenges. It's interesting in terms of the data, and just commenting on some things said before, participation in golf's pretty steady. It's around about, under ERAS studies, about 1.18 million people are playing golf on some sort of basis annually. So the participation stayed fairly steady. Club memberships declined by probably about 1% per annum over the last decade or so. Some of that, I think we were definitely at a high water mark in the 90s, and probably largely on the back of Greg Norman and his profile and presence in Australia. So some of that has eked away. There are certainly some time issues, without a doubt. I think in terms of club membership, what we've seen happen, certainly over the last 10 years, is clubs have become more flexible in terms of their product offerings. I guess if you went back 10 or 15 years, there were a number of golf clubs with waiting lists. If you wanted to play any amount of golf, you really had to join a club in some form. And with these new courses coming on stream, that's certainly changed a bit. And I think it has forced clubs to make some changes in terms of their product offerings, to be more flexible with memberships. Things like, instead of paying a joining fee as a bulk amount up front, paying it off over a period of time, over a number of years. Those sort of innovations, I think, have helped clubs. There's certainly, I think, some way to go, but it's not all bad news out there for clubs at all.
When I started playing golf, I was in my teenage years, and quite a few people, actually, quite a few of my friends played golf at that age. Is it the case that fewer younger people are taking up the game these days?
No, it's not that fewer younger people are. I think perhaps younger girls, we've got some real challenges in that space. But what we're really finding is that black hole, say from 23, 25 through to about 40, 45, I think these days, if you compared to say 15, 20 years ago, there's far more demands in terms of work and also far more demands in terms of family. I think fathers have become probably more engaged fathers and spending a lot more time with the kids. So I think golf's big challenge is particularly for clubs, is to creating better family environments where it's golf isn't necessarily time away from the family. It could be time with the family.
Mike Clatton, let me bring you into the discussion. You actually take issue with the suggestion that golf club membership is too expensive in Australia.
Well, if you can compare it with America, it's unbelievably cheap.
I mean,
we spoke about Royal Melbourne before. To think you can play a golf course, one of the best, in my opinion, five or ten in the world. You know, there is a club on Long Island next to Shinnecock Hills that's $650,000 to join. I mean, there are a lot of clubs in America, not so much in the last couple of years, but were, you know, six-figure sums to join and, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. So to think you can play a course as remarkable as Royal Melbourne or Kingston Heath for $4,000 a year, whilst it's not cheap, it's certainly by world terms not expensive at all.
Yeah.
And I think in Australia, New Zealand and Britain, those three countries have made the game remarkably accessible in terms of cost. You know, it's much more expensive and exclusive on the continent in Europe, and it's generally much more expensive in America. But Australia's, everyone can play golf, really.
We're talking about golf on Australia Talks. Love to hear from you if you're a golfer, even if you're a lapsed golfer. Give us a call, 1300 22 55 76. There is a spare line. Give us a call now and we'll have a chat to you about why you play or maybe why you've given up playing. You can also post your thoughts on our website. Just search ABC Australia Talks or tweet us using the hashtag AusTalks. Mike Clatton, in your view, a bigger problem facing Australia's golf clubs is the fact that there's actually too many of them, and this is affecting the financial viability of them. But do we need to get rid of a few golf courses?
Well, I think we do. When I started playing golf 40 years ago, the quality of public golf was poor. Now, in Melbourne, where I'm from, you can play at Bumboogle Dunes, which is a top 50 ranked course in the world. You can 13th Beats, the Dunes, Moona Links. There are some tremendous public golf courses now. So that's changed. I think that as clubs struggle, there are, in Melbourne, there are groups of courses, for instance, Keysborough, Spring Valley, Southern, and Kingswood. Four courses, very close to each other, all competing, all probably seen as courses that are struggling more than they used to in terms of getting members to join. Mm. Would it be better off if there were two thriving clubs and four struggling clubs? I think it would be, but, you know, the question for the game is, which ones do you lose? Do you lose... I mean, for me, as a golf course architect, the most important thing is you retain the best pieces of architecture, not the clubs who happen to be lucky to survive because, you know, they're closer to the train station or it's not so far home in a taxi if you're drunk or whatever.
Mm.
You know, so I think there are too many clubs, and the key for the game is to make sure it retains the best golf courses.
Yeah. Richard Fellner, you'd agree with that, that we do need to perhaps rationalise some golf courses. In fact, I should say that one of the courses near where I used to live in Doncaster in Melbourne, Eastern, my grandfather used to play there actually, is one of the membership-only courses that did actually close down and was subdivided for housing. Perhaps there should be more of that given, as we keep hearing, the shortage of land for housing redevelopment in Australia.
Well, I absolutely agree that there's probably too many courses out there. I think there does need to be some consolidation. And just think about it. If Kingswood and Keysborough combined into one club, you've got two fantastic courses for, you know, one membership fee. So there's a lot of win-win situations out there. You know, it's funny about Eastern. They have sold their land. So they haven't carved it up yet. Mm. They still have to build their new course out in Yering before they move. And a lot of people are pretty upset about that in the sense that, you know, it's a beautiful piece of property. You know, golf courses are the lungs of the city and, you know, there's so many benefits to having a golf course. But, you know, when they're getting, you know, $1 squillion for the land, you know, it's hard to compete. But, you know, there are too many courses. I think that speaking what you were talking about before about, you know, getting innovative, you look at a course like Keysborough, they just came out with a new type of membership model that's a credits system. So you buy X number of credits and you when you play, you use a certain number of credits and you keep the rest in the bank. You know, it's things like that that are very innovative that, you know, today's family or, you know, the golfer appreciates a bit more. So there are some very innovative things going on out there. Mm.
Talking about golf on Australia Talks, we just had mention a moment ago of the fact that it's a challenge to get teenage girls to play golf. We've got, I think, a woman golfer on the line now from Diamond Creek. It's Tina. Hi, Tina.
Oh, hello. How are you all?
Very well. Now, yeah. you still play golf?
I actually do play golf. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of 50-ish, a little bit over 50.
Mm-hmm.
And I work full-time.
Yeah.
I play on a Sunday. I'm a member of a private course because it suits because of the time frame on a public course. It takes longer on a public course. Expensive because, you know, you're sort of around about $1,600 for the year and can only play on a Sunday because of work commitments. But it's for me, it's a way of relaxing because I have a very stressful job. I find it's very difficult to get younger women because their mother, you know, their mums can't get away to play. Our club's sort of dwindling with our ladies because, you know, it's an expense for young families. We have three sons who are all pretty good golfers, but, can't, you know, they're buying their homes and what have you. So for me, it's relaxing most of the time.
It is one of the most frustrating games. I must say it was principally the reason that I stopped playing because I no longer found it relaxing. I'd come off the golf course with a headache.
But, I mean, there's frustrations with that when you have, you know, like the club championships on and it's the men's club championships and the courses are closed on a Sunday and you can't play and, you know, you pay the fees. But, you know, at the end of the day, I suppose that's my choice to stay as a member because you get the advantages of the club membership.
What's your handicap, Tina?
22.
And is it going down or going up?
It was actually going out because I'm only playing one day a week.
Got to get back on the course. A couple of rounds a week at least.
Yeah, if we could, we would.
Good to talk to you.
Right, thank you very much.
Tina in Diamond Creek, 1322-55-76. Stephen Pitt, is there a way to control, do you think, this proliferation of golf courses? There was a time, actually it's still the case, where you see ads for new real estate developments backed on to golf courses. It seems that a lot of real estate development these days, a lot of upmarket real estate development, goes hand in hand with a golf course attached to the real estate development.
Yeah, well, if you look at a number of developments, the golf course has been, I guess, the attractor or the centrepiece of those developments, and it has driven a number of developments across the country. The danger with some of those is that there's great land sales and a lot of money made off the land and developer walks away and leaves an operation that may not be sustainable into the long term. But I guess for us, in terms of number of golf courses, it's probably a supply-demand issue. And from Golf Australia's perspective, our charter is to try to get more people playing golf. So that's the challenge for us, how to get more people playing golf and hopefully current people playing golf playing more often and converting that into a greater engagement with the game, whether it be membership or just more frequent play.
Another big issue for golf is the development of new and better equipment, certainly better equipment than when I was playing golf fairly regularly. Golf balls that travel further, golf clubs that hit those golf balls further. Mike Clayton, that might sound like a good thing, but you're actually quite concerned about how this is affecting the game.
Yeah, I would take issue with the fact it's better equipment. I think it's been a disaster for the game in terms... it's a disaster for the game, I think, because it's completely reduced the level of skill it takes to play it properly. And so for poorer players, arguably, they think it's easier, but I don't see the scores coming down. And in terms of the way the great architects saw their courses playing, and most of the great courses were built, certainly in Australia, most of the great courses were built in the 20s. If the architects came back now and saw the way they played, I mean, you know, if Alistair McKenzie came back next week and watched Tiger Woods play at Royal Melbourne, he wouldn't recognise the game, and he would be furious at what happened because he was writing in 1920 that the ball was going too far. So the equipment manufacturer will say, well, yeah, this has been going on forever and why should we worry about it? But, you know, the role of the rules, well, the role of the equipment rules was to maintain the skill it took to play the game and to protect the integrity of the golf courses.
Yes.
And to me, the people who run the game of utterly failed to do that.
I suppose on the other hand, Mike, golf is a very, very hard game to master. If new equipment comes along that makes it easier for new golfers to get better at the game, isn't that a good thing for the sport? Maybe to encourage more people to play it?
I mean, I started caddying for bloke 22 handicappers or 27 handicappers in 1970. Easton, ironically, which, you know, we're talking about the golf club, I lived on the back of Easton, so it's kind of sad to see that thing go. But, you know, I mean, I caddy for old men who love to play golf, and, you know, they shot 95 or 100, the same as the equivalent 65-year-old bloke. They still shoot 95 or 100 because the way you play is essentially determined by your technique and not your equipment. The one shot that no one ever hit with a wooden driver was a massive block to the right. I see that shot all the time now because you get young guys with a big head and they smash it and it just goes miles to the right. So, I mean, I think people hit the ball crookeder. I don't see people having any more fun playing golf than they were 100 years ago. I mean, people love to play golf when they play with hickory sharps. So, you know, to me, the fun of golf is not so much the score you shoot, but the people you're with, the shots you hit, the feel of your swing and the golf holes you play.
Yep. So I'm going to bring someone in at this point who has a degree of expertise in this issue of new equipment or relatively new equipment that's come to the game of golf. Matt Tudor is the National Technical Representative and Tour Support for Callaway Golf. Hello, Matt.
Good evening. How are you going?
Good. What do you think about this new equipment that's available today for golfers? Is it ruining the game, as Mike Clayton suggests?
Oh, I don't think so. I think certainly in the amateur ranks, I think it's a good thing because, I mean, we want more people playing golf. So I guess if the golf clubs are more forgiving and they're enjoying the game by hitting better shots, well, I think that encourages the youth to come up and play. And I mean, you could use the example of baseball. I mean, in baseball, in the pro ranks, they've moved away from them using titanium bats because they're hitting the ball out of the park. So now they're going back to wood. So with the amateur baseball players, they're allowed to use the titanium bat. So that sort of encourages them, gives them confidence to play. So I think it's the same with golf. If we've got, you know, technology that's helping us move forward, helping the golfers and certainly the younger kids play better by having bigger heads, wider sweet spots, hitting better shots, I think that's going to promote the game and actually have them more involved and keep them going.
Does there need to be a limit put on how far we can go, how far golf balls can go, how far you can drive a golf ball with a golf driver? Do we need to cap the development somehow?
I think the golf ball is probably the biggest question, but In regards to the driver, I mean, we all know the biggest you can go now in cubic centimetres for a driver is 460, so they've sort of capped it at that, which is a good thing. But I think Mike may have mentioned before, like, the golf ball is the thing that's going further. And actually, interesting, I had a gentleman come into the performance centre here at Callaway the other day, and he actually brought in an old persimmon wood. And I actually had a hit of that persimmon wood with a Callaway golf ball, and then used one of the modern drivers, our Razor Hawk driver. And the shot didn't go that much further. Now, it was more because of the golf ball. Okay, so the same, it might have went 10 or 15 yards further, but that sort of tells me now that, okay, the persimmon wood was going a long way, but the golf ball is probably what's actually making the distance come into it more with these modern day clubs.
Just hang on a sec, Matt. I've got Peter from Sydney who's just called in on the line, and Peter is actually a golf pro. G'day, Peter.
Oh, hello there.
What do you think about this issue of the new golfing technology, golf balls that are travelling further, golf clubs that are hitting those balls further? Is this a good thing or a bad thing for the game?
Well, I'm not sure that golfers have got any better with all of the technology, and I'm firmly in the opinion that the secret's in the software, not in the hardware. And I'd like to see the game sort of simplified and made a little bit less complicated in lots of ways.
How so?
Well, I think that people have got too complicated in their thinking to start with, and the whole area of technique and the sort of equipment you should be using, and I think the idea that the secret lies outside ourselves rather than in finding something within ourselves.
Yes, okay, thanks for that, Peter, in Sydney. As I say, love to hear from you if you are a golfer or not on 1300 22 55 76. Stephen Pitt, is this an area where maybe golfing authorities could step in to limit the impact of new technology?
I think they already are in terms of the size of clubs and so forth, size of drivers principally. I guess Michael's point is that the horse may have already bolted in relation to the ball, and I guess it is difficult to wind something back in that sense.
Mike, what do you think about that? Would you like to see authorities take a tougher line on this?
Well, the problem is, the ball's the problem because it goes too far in the hands of good players. So, but the people who run the game, one, they're scared of being sued by the equipment manufacturers. So that question is, who runs the game? Do Callaway and Titleist run the game, or do the R&A and the USGA run the game? And what the R&A don't want to do is bifurcate the rules and have a separate ball for elite players. But in insisting on one ball or one ball rule, then they've created two completely different games. The game the average amateur plays, the game that Jeff Ogilvie and Tiger Woods plays, are so far apart now because those guys are... I mean, Ian Baker Finch, who still hits the ball pretty well. Finch, he played with Rory McIlroy two weeks ago. He said, Finch said, I had a good drive and a 100-yard sandwich. He said, Rory drove it 10 yards off the green. He said he was 90 yards past me. So in having one ball, they create two games. If they had two balls, i.e. a ball for amateurs and a ball for elite players, they can actually get back to something closer to one game, at least, where the best players were 40 yards ahead of the average player and not 80 or 90 yards ahead.
Yes. Now, the other issue, and I've got to say something that really gets up my nose, Richard Filner, the long putter. It's controversial. It has dramatically improved the game of many a golfer, but some call it a cheat stick. How do you see the long putter, Richard?
Oh, boy. Well, look, I'm a traditionalist. I don't really like the long putter. A lot of people argue that because it's either touching your chest or touching your chin or wherever, that you've got a third point of contact and therefore it's cheating. I don't necessarily believe that, but I think that the long putter does take out a lot of the hands aspect of the game. And if you've got the yips or, if you've got the nerves, you should be able to calm them down yourself, internally, and not necessarily use a tool like a long putter to do that. That said, I look at some of these players out there that are doing so well with the putter. I think it's great for golf. If if an amateur goes out there and, you know, he wants to play more golf, if he can play more golf because of this, you know, I think it's good. So I'm kind of torn, even though I'm, like I said, a bit of a traditionalist.
Yes.
But, you know, it's a lot of people believe now that it's a bit too late to ban them because they've been around for years. And, you know, so and, you know, looking at technology like that, like the ball and all these other things, you know, it is a bit late to ban them. But if you look at the elite level, you know, maybe the pros, you know, shouldn't be playing with these long putters, and maybe they should be playing with one ball that's, you know, that's, you know, limited in distance a little bit.
Let me put those 2 points to you, Matt Tudor from Callaway Golf. First of all, the broomstick putter. Do you think it should be restricted in golf competition?
Well, from a selling point of view for Callaway and Odyssey, no, because it's selling through very well. But I've always believed...
What about as a lover of the game?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a traditionalist too. I think if something's sort of anchored to your body, then it's sort of it's helping. I think it shouldn't be attached to your body. It's helping you in some way. So, and we've seen the shift. I mean, I think 15% of the players on tour now are using either the mid putter or the long putter. So it's certainly heading in that direction, and it must be easier for the guys to be using this putter, and i.e. the yips, you know, take away the hands. So.
That's the putter. Now, this issue of the ball, would you like to see two balls, one for the pros, one for the amateurs, or is that a problem in itself? You know, one of the attractions of golf used to be the handicap system where the person off 30 could have a round of golf with the person off 8 or 5 and still be, you know, still play a round of golf with them. Does the two-ball thing really, you know, further segregate the amateurs and the pros?
That works for me. I agree with that. I think there should be two golf balls. I think one for the pro and one for the amateur. As I touched on before, I think we want to encourage the game for the young kids coming through. So if it helps them, enhances them to hit the ball further, helps them to hit it further, well, then that's great. But then once they move into the elite level, if they do turn pro, well, then that's when you're up against the challenges of going back to a golf ball that doesn't sort of travel quite as far. So, yeah, you know, it led me to that question before. I think that for the amateurs, it should be certainly different to what it is with the pros.
Okay, good to talk to you. Matt Tudor, National Technical Representative and Tour Support for Callaway Golf. We're talking about golf on Australia Talks, the finer points of the game and, in fact, the threats posed to golf. Many a fine golfer has come out of this country, but it is facing challenges at the moment. Too many golf courses, the fact that it takes a long time to play a round of golf, and we're too busy these days to play it as often as we used to. Give us a call with your thoughts, 1300 22 55 76. Should we get rid of that long broom-handled putter that they're using and the golf balls that travel for miles? Love to hear from you. Let's go to Ian in Perth, who's new to the game of golf. Is that right, Ian?
That's right. Less than a year now, and I enjoy it very much. Took it up because I had to stop playing active sports like soccer, so it's more of a social thing for me.
Yep.
But I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. One, I got into it very cheaply. I got my clubs from a Salvo store.
Yep.
So I paid $5 for a driver, and it goes just as well as people are paying hundreds for. And I play on a public course, and I have a great time doing it.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Sounds like the same way I used to play the game. And to David, who I think's on the line from Barrel, is that right, David?
Yes, that's right.
Hi.
I'm just going to say, I think the game, I mean, it's an ancient game and people would cringe, but I think the problem today is young people have the money, but they don't have the time. Everything's happening so fast. And they need to bring a competitive round down to 9 or 12 holes and make it legitimate. I really think 18 holes, 4.5 hours, that's what everybody complains about.
Yep. Yeah, well, look, that's what's happening to cricket increasingly.
I used to ride horses and in eventing, where we're the Olympic gold medal winners of. They've reduced certain things in that. They've modernised it. And all sports have to be modernised, just like baseball was, you know, like cricket, you know, shorter game for cricket, all that sort of business. It's just, I think time is the problem.
Yep, okay. Thanks to David in Barrel and to Alan in Queensland. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how you going?
Good, thanks.
Yes, first I'd like to say how much I'm enjoying listening to the panel and... I agree with everything they've said virtually, but I'd just like to put my opinion in as to why I think memberships are declining.
Yes.
I've been a member of a golf course for over 40 years. I've noticed a decline, particularly in the last few years, and it's the demographics are changing, I believe, because people have to work longer hours, and time is a factor, but I don't understand it personally because I love the game and I think it's a metaphor for life, and I think a lot of people are impatient now. They want instant gratification with to be able to play and learn the game quickly, whereas I had to pay my dues and work hard at the game, and I think a lot of people don't want to do that also.
Yep, they say, Alan, I'm sure you've heard it, that you learn more about a man playing a round of golf with him than you do in a lifetime of knowing him.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your call. Alan, in Queensland, talking about golf with Richard Fellner from Inside Golf, Steve and Pitt from Golf Australia, and Mike Clayton, golf course architect and former European Pro Tour player. Look, Steve and Pitt, we've talked about some of the challenges, some of the difficulties facing golf. There is a very big selling point for golf, though, which no doubt appeals to the baby boomers. Golfers live longer, don't they?
Yeah, and that's great news for all of us. There's been some extensive studies done in Sweden showing that golfers live around about 5 years longer than non-golfers. And they've taken into account all the various demographic issues and so forth. But it's all about getting out, having regular exercise. And that's one of the terrific things about golf. You can do it from very young to basically the day you die for a lot of people. So it's cradle to grave, and it gets people out active, keeps them active, but also keeps them socially engaged, which is terrifically important. So it's when you look at golf, I mean, it has a very positive impact on the lives of, you know, a million Australians each year. So it's incredibly, I think, beneficial to Australia on that basis, and it's certainly, we're looking to do a lot more in terms of partnering with government on health initiatives and health and wellbeing type programs. So that is the great news for golf. It's for a lot of people, it's such an important part of their life.
It's providing people don't use the powered golf buggies. I will come to that if I've got time, actually, that issue. It's another one of the things that's somewhat of a concern. Richard Fellner, we've got Tiger Woods in the country at the moment, perhaps not quite the fanfare that would have meant, you know, 5 years ago or so. But nonetheless, you've described this series of major golf events just ahead of us in Australia this summer as the biggest summer of golf ever in this country. Do you think it'll be enough to maybe get some former golf players, some lapsed golfers, back on the golf course again?
Well, I absolutely hope so. I mean, we've got, maybe 7 of the top 10, I think, players in the world coming down. There's, I was writing a preview, and all of the names that are in there, like Dustin Johnson, Bubba Watson, Hunter Mahan, I mean, it goes on and on and on. So, you know, if we can get the golfers to come out to these events and just watch these superstars just, you know, smash the ball and do, you know, some really, really amazing things with the ball, you know, it'll inspire them. And, you know, if they take their kids to these tournaments, the kids will get inspired. So, you know, that's the first step. I think that, you know, inspiring people to get out and play golf is the first step. And I think that, you know, then you follow it up afterwards with, you know, good programs. And I think Golf Australia's My Golf program, for example, is a fantastic program. Stephen can kind of talk about that, but it's about, you know, getting juniors out there and you know, playing and, you know, connecting to the schools and things like that. And it's, you know, once you then nurture that, you know, you can make the next step and get them out playing.
Yep.
So we certainly hope. I mean, it right now seems to be the best time ever, or at least in recent memory, to really make a push for golf and get people back out on the course.
Mike Clayton, talking about juniors, it used to be the case that kids would caddy for their parents, when Dad had a round of golf on the weekend, his son would come along, maybe swing some of the clubs as they were walking along the fairways. Don't seem to be that many kids who are caddying these days. Is that a problem, really, in terms of getting them interested in the game?
Well, it was a great avenue into the game. I mean, Bob Shearer, Stuart Ginn, the generation before me in Melbourne all caddied. I used to caddy for the car dealer, Kevin Dennis, and he taught me more about
really?
Grinding on a golf course than any golf pro ever did. I mean, he was the most intense player I've ever seen. He was 22 cigarettes around, and boy, did he create. I mean, amazing. You could see why he was a successful car dealer. And he paid me $4 a round, which was four times as much as old Howard Hamilton paid me a dollar a round. Kevin Dennis turned up and started paying me $4 a round.
And, so, and you got a few life lessons along the way, no doubt.
Pretty staggering wage. But Jeff Ogilvie used to caddy at Royal Melbourne. He was really kind of the last, I suppose, generation of caddies who, I mean, you don't see them now, but it was a great way into the game. Those old guys were terrible players, but they taught me where to stand. And I loved playing, and you know, we would play in the Saturday morning, and while they putted out, my mate and I would go and hit balls off the next tee while they were putting out. So it was kind of crazy, really, but it was a great way into the game. The only caddies I've run into now, there are two old guys at Bunbougle, one retired school teacher. They caddy at Bunbougle and make, look, I shouldn't, you know, the taxman might be on them, but I mean, these guys are making $500 a week carrying clubs at Bunbougle, and Richard Tatler, the owner, lets them play the course when the course is not busy. And a friend of mine's the Jewish club on Long Island, actually where Bernie Madoff was a member. And I mean, he has, during the summer, 50 or 60 school teachers on holidays who caddy, and they make a lot of money out of it. So it's a big part of the game in America and Britain, but you don't see it here.
Okay. I just want to stay with this issue. Perhaps Stephen Pitt, you're the best person to answer it. This issue of how we get kids involved in the sport. Again, it seems that whenever we have a dip in sporting participation or sporting success in a sport in Australia, like tennis, for example, the finger is pointed at the authorities. You're not doing enough to attract the next generation of kids to the sport. Is Golf Australia doing enough to attract kids to the game, or is there just too much competition for their activities these days?
No, I don't think there's too much competition. I'd certainly say also golf's in the fortunate position that it's we haven't dipped in terms of performance. The golden period is continuing as far as Australian golf goes. Richard touched on a program that we have launched in the last 12 months called My Golf, and I firmly believe this will be a transformational type program for golf in Australia, and it's aimed at kids between 8 and 14, 8 and 15, that sort of age group. And it's designed to get a club in their hand, particularly if they've never played before, get a club in their hand. There's six different categories: rip it, roll it, blast it, bend it, fly it, chip it. So it's sort of funky type things, and they basically get nurtured through those early stages of the game. The other terrific thing about MyGolf, it works in a modified format in schools. So we take out the rip it, which is a driving component, and one or two others, the blasted out of bunkers we can't really do in schools. But we use that modified program, link it in with schools, get development officers into schools, and then try to link them into golf clubs. And it's a terrific vehicle for golf clubs to use for those kids at 8 to 12, 8 to 14, who may not have played before and may not be at a point where they feel comfortable going out on the golf course, but just nurtures them through that early stages and builds a link and hopefully a love with the game of golf.
Kate's posted on our website on Australia Talks, "I'm not a player, but my husband's played for 40 years. I hope to learn when I retire. I've attended and enjoyed two British Opens as well as numerous other tournaments." Thanks, Kate, for that. Richard Felder, at the elite level, is golf still attracting enough sponsorship and prize money in Australia?
Look, that's a tough one in Australia. I think, you know, it's probably a lot lower than where it could be. But, you know, these days, especially with the GFC and so many things, it's a hard sell. It's hard for a company to pour all sorts of money into it and see any kind of real measurable return. So it's difficult. I think there's a long, long way to go, and we can get it up. And I think we need to. If you look at, you know, some of these prize purses out there internationally, you know, the winner gets, you know, 1.something million, versus in Australia, that's the entire prize purse, and the winner might get 260,000. So I think we need to bump those up if we want to get more of these international players. But it's a hard sell.
Mike Clayton, what about star power as far as Australian golfers is concerned? Greg Norman, of course, was a huge name in Australian golf. Do we have or do we lack star power at the moment?
Well, Greg was unique. My dad took me to watch Peter Thompson. He was the star when I was a kid in the late 60s, and he was an amazing player to watch. But he wasn't Greg Norman, but he was arguably a better player. But, I mean, Greg was Greg, and there was no one like Greg except for Seve Ballesteros and Arnold Palmer. So there have been three, perhaps, you know, incredibly charismatic players in the last sort of 60 years. There was never going to be another Greg. So we have Adam Scott, Jason Day, Jeff Ogilvy, you know, Robert Allenby, John Sendon, who no one's really ever heard of, but Sendon's been in the top three ball strikers for the last 10 years on the US Tour. So if someone wants to watch a great ball striker play this week, go and watch John Sendon. But who knows John Sendon? If you looked at the main list, the guy makes $2 million a year and plays great golf, but he's not a high-profile player. But Greg was Greg, and there's never going to be another Greg. You know, there'll never be another Arnold Palmer in America. There'll never be another Seve Ballesteros in Europe. You just kind of evolved a different player. So Tiger's a different animal from Arnold Palmer, and
yes.
Palmer's a different animal from Ben Hogan and Bobby Jones. So the game kind of evolves, and there are different characters.
I wonder though, Stephen Pitt, whether we should be doing more to promote the image of the game, doing more to try and cultivate another star. I mean, we've got the talent in terms of actually playing the game, as Mike Clayton has said. Is there something we can do to get a bit more charisma on display?
I think you can always get to know the players better than what we do at the moment, and I think maybe that's an issue that perhaps TV audiences and attendees at tournaments don't quite get the connection with some of these players. I think players have become a little bit more robotic, if you like, in terms of their pre-shot routines and their demeanour on courses. I guess there's been a heavy involvement from the sports sciences and keeping calm and so forth. But I think also it is, as Mike touched on, Greg Norman was a freak in some ways, just in terms of his charisma. And it wasn't just an Australian issue. He was loved and watched just as much in the US. He was a prime driver of TV ratings in the US during that period as well. He spent 5 years at number one.
So, had that great nickname, the Great White Shark, as well.
That's right. Mm. And we shouldn't also forget about our great female players. We've had, you know, maybe Australia's greatest golfer in the last 100 years has been Kari Webb, certainly in terms of majors. But she's been a terrific player and is still, you know, top 10 player in the world, which is phenomenal. She's been that way for a long, long time. And then you've got Catherine Hull, Lindsay Wright and some others.
Thanks for reminding us of that. Let's just finish up on a call or two and we'll head to Mackay. Don't know why everybody rings up at the last moment. Let's head to Mackay and John. Hello, John.
Yeah, hi. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Now, you wanted to talk about what? About the availability of places in clubs?
Regional club, Queensland.
Yeah.
Okay. Cheap to join the club.
Yep.
Here's our problem, 12-hour shifts.
Right, okay. So people just don't have the time to play.
Do you know what our club survives on? Social players.
Mm.
Now...
And why is that a problem?
Well, the problem is you don't have representative players joining clubs. What you have are players who come and play to play the game. So, in actual fact, our club survives social players.
Mm.
These guys haven't got the time because they're doing so many hours' work, they cannot play in your weekly competitions. Australia works around competitions on the weekend.
It sounds like another downside, actually, of the mining boom, John, that all of the men around Mackay are too busy working those long mining shifts, perhaps. Thanks to John in Mackay, that's where we're going to have to leave our discussion on golf for today. Thanks very much to our guests tonight, Richard Fellner, the group editor of Inside Golf, Stephen Pitt, CEO of Golf Australia, and Mike Clayton, golf course architect and former European tour player.